Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading the New York Times for Thursday, April 9, 2026. Uncertainty clouds ceasefire as Lebanon and Gulf states are struck. By Adam Rasgun, Yagana Tobati, Evan Ward, and Michael Levinson. A tenuous ceasefire between the United States and Iran was being tested on Wednesday by heavy Israeli bombardment in Lebanon, which Israel and President Trump insisted was not part of the ceasefire deal, and by continued Iranian attacks on its Persian Gulf neighbors. Although the ceasefire promised to bring 2 weeks of relative calm to the Middle East and buy time for Iran and the United States to hammer out a longer-term peace deal, many questions remained about the fate of Iran's highly enriched uranium, the safe passage of ships in the Strait of Hormuz, and whether ongoing Iranian and Israeli attacks could upend the diplomatic process. Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif of Pakistan, who helped broker the ceasefire that was announced on Tuesday, wrote on social media on Wednesday that violations had been reported in several places, which undermine the spirit of the peace process. I earnestly and sincerely urge all parties to exercise restraint and respect the ceasefire for 2 weeks as agreed upon so that diplomacy can take a lead role towards peaceful settlement of the conflict, he wrote. Talks aimed at a long-term agreement were set to begin on Saturday in Islamabad, Pakistan's capital. Iran's Supreme National Security Council confirmed that Iranian leaders would take part in the negotiations. The Trump administration said it would send Vice President J.D. Vance, Steve Witkoff, a special envoy, and Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law. Mr. Trump said that his administration would work closely with Iran, a stark shift in tone after he demanded Tehran's unconditional surrender for weeks and threatened to destroy the country's whole civilization if it didn't reopen the Strait of Hormuz by Tuesday night. Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, said that U.S. officials were working on a modified peace plan that would closely mirror a 15-point proposal that Mr. Trump put forward weeks ago, so long as the Strait of Hormuz remains open. The status of the strait was just one of many uncertainties on Wednesday. Iran, which had effectively choked off most crude oil and natural gas shipments through the strait during the war, was supposed to reopen the waterway during the 2-week ceasefire. But it was unclear if the strait was open on Wednesday and who was in control of it. One Iranian news outlet reported that shipping in the strait had been halted in response to Israeli attacks on Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed militia in Lebanon. Ms. Leavitt dismissed that report as false. "We have seen an uptick of traffic in the strait today," she told reporters at the White House, "and I will reiterate the president's expectation and demand that the Strait of Hormuz is reopened immediately, quickly, and safely." Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said the ceasefire with Iran was not the end of the battle. "It is a stop on the way to achieving all of our objectives," Mr. Netanyahu said in a statement on Wednesday. "We have more objectives to achieve, and we will achieve them, either by agreement or by resuming the fighting." Iranian leaders accused the United States of not holding up its side of the ceasefire, making the future of the truce even murkier. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, the Speaker of Iran's parliament, said the United States had already breached several principles of the deal. Israel was still attacking Hezbollah in Lebanon, which Mr. Ghalibaf said was a violation of the truce. He added that a hostile drone also entered Iranian airspace in violation of the ceasefire. Mr. Ghalibaf said the truce and the upcoming negotiations with the United States were unreasonable, given these issues and continuing U.S. opposition to Iranian nuclear enrichment. Still, he stopped short of saying Iran would pull out of the ceasefire or withdraw from the talks in Islamabad. Ms. Leavitt and Mr. Netanyahu said the ceasefire did not extend to Lebanon, contradicting Iran and Mr. Sharif, the Pakistani prime minister, who said that Lebanon was protected under the deal. On Wednesday, Israel carried out the biggest bombardment of Lebanon in its month-long war against Hezbollah, which started firing rockets into Israel in March in solidarity with Iran. Israeli jets pummeled the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and other parts of the country, with many strikes hitting densely populated areas without warning. The Israeli military said it had targeted more than 100 Hezbollah targets in the span of just 10 minutes. Residents had no time to flee, as munitions rained down on crowded neighborhoods, some once considered safe. At least 182 people were killed, and about 900 others were injured, according to Lebanon's health ministry, making it among the deadliest days since the war began. Search teams were looking for more bodies under the rubble of apartment buildings, and the sound of ambulances echoed across Beirut as plumes of thick, acrid smoke rose above the skyline. Lebanon's president, Joseph Aoun, said that Israel had committed a new massacre that adds to its black record. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps threatened a military response if the attacks on Lebanon were not immediately halted, Iranian state media reported. It said the retaliation would target aggressors in the region. For weeks, Israeli officials have publicly rebuffed overtures by Lebanon's government to hold direct talks about a ceasefire. Earlier on Wednesday, before the Israeli strikes, Mr. Aoun said that efforts were underway to ensure that any regional peace encompasses Lebanon. The truce was also strained by continued Iranian attacks reported by Persian Gulf countries on Wednesday. Kuwait's army said that since 8 a.m. local time, the country had faced 28 Iranian drone attacks, some of which had targeted vital oil and power facilities and caused extensive damage. In the United Arab Emirates, the defense ministry reported 17 ballistic missiles and 35 drone attacks launched by Iran since the beginning of the ceasefire. And the Saudi defense ministry said on Wednesday afternoon that it had intercepted 9 drones in recent hours without naming an attacker. It was unclear why the attacks were continuing, despite the truce and the beginning of what Mr. Trump called a big day for world peace. Iran's state media also reported that an oil refinery on Lavan, an Iranian island in the Persian Gulf, had been struck by unspecified enemies. Looming over the ceasefire was the possibility of further U.S. and Israeli military action in Iran. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters on Wednesday that all U.S. military objectives had been achieved in what Mr. Hegseth called a historic and overwhelming victory on the battlefield. But Mr. Hegseth suggested that Mr. Trump could still order a U.S. commando raid to seize Iran's stockpile of 970 pounds of highly enriched uranium. Such a mission would, at a minimum, involve hundreds of U.S. Special Operations troops and would come with high risks, current and former commanders say. "They will either give it to us," Mr. Hegseth said of the uranium, "or we'll take it out." For Iranians who have endured more than a month of intense Israeli and American strikes, the ceasefire stirred up a mix of emotions, relief, but also fear for the future. Schools, hospitals, homes, bridges, and roads were destroyed, as were major companies that employed tens of thousands and fueled Iran's economy. "Right now, it feels like a kind of limbo. I don't know how it will end, but the war was heading in directions that I found frightening," Iraj, a Tehran resident, said on Wednesday. "I just know that I feel better today compared to yesterday." He, like others who were interviewed, asked to be identified by first name only, fearing reprisal from the government. Mustafa, an IT engineer, said that people in areas that had faced daily bombardment were relieved at news of the ceasefire, and even more Iranians were happy that their water, electricity, and gas would not be cut off, given Mr. Trump's threats to bomb Iranian infrastructure. "The issue, however, is that the Islamic Republic is still in power," he said. "It will take months to get oil and gas flowing out of the Persian Gulf. by Rebecca F. Elliott and Ivan Penn. Reopening the Strait of Hormuz, a central aim for the United States when it agreed to a ceasefire with Iran, would be the first step toward getting more energy flowing through the Persian Gulf, but only the first step. That is because dozens of refineries, storage facilities, and oil and gas fields in at least 9 countries, from Iran to the United Arab Emirates and beyond, have been targeted in strikes. All told, 10% or more of the world's oil supply has been turned off. Restarting those operations will require not only safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz, but also inspecting pumps, replacing bespoke processing equipment, and recalling employees and ships that have scattered across the globe. "It's not a case of you just flick a switch and everything's back up again," said Martin Houston, a longtime oil and gas executive who now serves as board member for several energy companies. The timeline for bringing the Gulf energy system back to some semblance of normal is highly uncertain. For one thing, the war has been formally paused for only 2 weeks, and the ceasefire appeared to be on shaky ground, with attacks continuing across the region on Wednesday. Under the deal that President Trump announced Tuesday evening, Iran agreed to allow ships to pass through the strait without being attacked, but there was no sign on Wednesday that vessels were returning to the waterway in large numbers. Earlier that day, Mr. Trump said that if the waterway remained closed, "a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again." He has also repeatedly threatened to strike Iranian power plants and other critical infrastructure if Iran does not allow vessels to pass through the strait, acts that could be considered war crimes. Attacks on energy facilities continued in the days leading up to the ceasefire, including on an oil refinery in Kuwait and petrochemical complexes in Iran. How much damage has already been done to the region's infrastructure is difficult to know, because many countries have shared little information. Once companies regain confidence that their ships can transit the narrow waterway that runs between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula, the first order of business is likely to be shipping out the oil and other fuels that countries close to the strait stockpiled in storage tanks. Then, as long as hostilities do not resume, some wells are likely to flow again within days or weeks, industry analysts and Gulf oil executives say. But a fuller recovery will be a months-long process, they cautioned. And even then, some infrastructure that has sustained extensive damage is expected to take years to repair. For consumers, this means that gasoline prices at the pump, which recently topped $4 a gallon on average in the United States, are unlikely to return to their pre-war levels anytime soon, even though international oil prices fell considerably late Tuesday. Countries are using up stores of energy they had before the war, so the longer the war drags on, the stickier those high prices are likely to be. The shuttering of oil wells has other consequences. Once idled, oil and gas wells can be difficult to restart, and the longer they remain closed, the more trouble companies may have turning them back on. The pressure underground can get out of whack while wells are closed. Water can build up. If the shutdowns last a long time, equipment might corrode after being exposed to hydrogen sulfide for too long. The toxic gas, which smells like rotten eggs, is often found mixed in with oil and natural gas. Saudi Arabia and Iraq inject gas or water into many of their wells to coax out more oil, adding another layer of complexity to reestablishing the correct pressure when the time comes to reopen, the research firm Bloomberg NEF wrote recently. Kuwait, which is sandwiched between Saudi Arabia and Iraq at the tip of the Persian Gulf, is the world's 10th largest oil producer. Before Friday, when its Mina al-Ahmadi refinery was hit by a drone, the chief executive of the state-owned oil company Kuwait Petroleum said he expected to be able to bring out quite a bit of production immediately within a few days of the war's ending. Sheikh Nawaf al-Sabah, the chief executive, added during remarks late last month at an energy conference, CERAWeek, by S&P Global in Houston, that The full production will come within 3 or 4 months. The big question is how much damage has been sustained by all the infrastructure needed to get oil and gas from wellheads to world markets. Analysts say few installations appear to have suffered catastrophic harm, but they are working with limited information about most facilities. One of the most important energy assets in the region is Qatar's natural gas export plant, Ras Laffan. The site, which spans at least 3 square miles in a large industrial city, supplies countries throughout Asia and Europe with natural gas that people use for cooking, heating homes, and generating electricity. Before it can be loaded on a ship, natural gas must be turned into a liquid by cooling it at about minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 162 degrees Celsius. Qatar stopped making this liquefied natural gas, or LNG, during the early days of the war. Missiles later took out 17% of the site's capacity. The undamaged parts of the facility would be restarted first, likely over a period of weeks or months. Steps include reopening the offshore gas wells that feed the export terminal, restarting any utilities that had been turned off, restocking the inventory of fuels used to cool the gas, known as refrigerants, and then actually cooling the gas, said Mehdi Touil, who spent more than a decade at Ras Laffan and is now the lead LNG specialist at Calypso Commodities, a Berlin company. The damaged portions are another matter. Qatar Energy, which operates Ras Laffan, said it will take several years to repair those areas and bring them online. The company did not respond to requests for comment. Ras Laffan has 14 LNG producing units. The strikes last month took out the heart of two of them, the mammoth structures in which gas is cooled, Qatar Energy's chief executive told Reuters. That equipment can be as tall as an 18-story building, and the lead time for a new one can run 2 years or more, industry officials said. These facilities were custom-engineered and integrated into the broader Ras Laffan complex, making them substantially more difficult to replace than simpler kinds of energy infrastructure, said Najmuddin Meshkati, a professor of engineering at the University of Southern California. Less is known about the extent of the damage to oil processing facilities throughout the region. A refinery on the west coast of Saudi Arabia had been operating at much lower levels after a drone strike in mid-March, according to Rystad Energy, an Oslo-based consulting firm. Rystad estimated that the refinery most likely could be fully restored within a year. Iran has also suffered attacks on its energy infrastructure, including strikes on oil depots in Tehran that turned the sky over the capital city black. One concern for rebuilding is that supply chains for some specialized parts have already been stretched thin. The rush to build data centers for artificial intelligence has created a demand for gas-fired power plants and other energy infrastructure. Many of those facilities rely on equipment, like gas turbines, that may also be needed to make repairs in the Gulf. If you have the right supply chain, you can get things built back pretty quickly, said Mike Stice, a University of Oklahoma professor who serves on the board of energy companies, including the U.S. refining giant Marathon Petroleum. But, he added, timelines will depend a lot on what has been damaged. All it takes is one critical piece of equipment that has a 2-year delivery date. In the end, however, the conflict plays out. Analysts expect energy prices to eventually fall from wartime levels, but remain higher than they would have been in the absence of war. Analysts at the French bank Société Générale recently said they expected oil to trade around $80 a barrel at the end of 2026, up from their earlier forecast of $65. Traders will be pricing in a greater risk of geopolitical disruption in the future. Trump says he exceeded his objectives in Iran, but what did he accomplish? By Anton Troyanovsky. President Trump went to war on February 28, pledging to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, destroy its missile capability, break its regional proxies, eliminate its navy, and create an opening for regime change. After 5 weeks of bombardment, Mr. Trump agreed to a ceasefire with none of those goals clearly accomplished. In his social media post on Tuesday announcing the end of U.S. bombing for now, if Iran reopens the Strait of Hormuz, Mr. Trump said, "We have already met and exceeded all military objectives." Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told reporters on Wednesday that the United States had achieved a historic and overwhelming victory because Iran's military had been rendered combat ineffective for years to come. Still, even supporters of the president's decision to go to war voiced doubts that Iran had in fact been defeated. Mark Levin, the Fox News host whom Mr. Trump often praises, lamented in primetime on Tuesday night that the Iranian regime was still surviving. Laura Loomer, the far-right activist close to the White House, posted online that, "We didn't really get anything out of the ceasefire talks, and the terrorists in Iran are celebrating." Lindsey Graham, the hawkish Republican senator from South Carolina, warned that Congress would need to review any deal. The hand-wringing from the president's staunchest backers highlighted the disconnect between the vast firepower of the U.S. military on display over the last month and the war's more complicated consequences for U.S. security and influence. It was an indicator of the discomfort with the outcome of a war that, for now, has left the Middle East looking markedly different from the ambitions that Mr. Trump laid out when he announced the start of major combat operations more than a month ago. This regime will soon learn that no one should challenge the strength and might of the United States Armed Forces, Mr. Trump said in that overnight video message on February 28, wearing a USA baseball cap. But Iran did challenge the United States, even as the U.S. military struck more than 13,000 targets, according to figures released by the Pentagon on Wednesday. Iran attacked U.S. partners in the Middle East and closed down shipping out of the Persian Gulf. The result? While Mr. Trump said at the war's start that, "We will ensure that Iran does not obtain a nuclear weapon," he declared the ceasefire with hundreds of pounds of highly enriched uranium still in Iran's possession. The president said on Wednesday on social media that there would be no enrichment of uranium and that the United States would be working with Iran to dig up and remove its stockpile. But there was no indication that Iran had agreed to such terms. Mr. Trump also promised to destroy their missiles and raise their missile industry to the ground. General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said on Wednesday that the U.S. bombs had hit more than 450 ballistic missile storage facilities and 80% of Iran's missile production facilities. Richard Goldberg, a senior advisor at the hawkish Foundation for Defense of Democracies think tank, estimated that as much as one-third of Iran's missile arsenal remained intact and cautioned that we either get dismantlement or we don't. The United States did, by all accounts, succeed in sinking much of Iran's navy. Caroline Levitt, the White House press secretary, said that 97% of Iran's more than 5,000 naval mines had been destroyed and that the country now had zero submarine vessels. But the ceasefire has gone into effect with Iran retaining maritime power where it matters most for the world economy, in the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran has been able to shutter with small boats, drones, and missiles fired from shore. Mr. Trump had insisted that Iran reopen the strait as part of the ceasefire. The strait's status was not clear on Wednesday, as Ms. Levitt contended that the waterway had seen more vessels going through, but shipping monitors did not show an increase in traffic. Either way, Iran appeared to retain the ability, if it chose, to continue harassing commercial ships and deterring them from passing through. When it comes to Iran's network of proxy forces, Ms. Levitt said that Tehran can no longer distribute weapons to its proxies in the region, and that Iran's ability to fund those groups had been greatly reduced. But they still pose a threat. Israel is continuing its war on the Hezbollah militant group in Lebanon, while the Houthi militia in Yemen signaled in recent days that it could still join the fighting. And Iran's theocratic regime remains in power, potentially with even greater military control over the country. The U.S.-Israeli air campaign killed numerous senior officials, including Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader. But there is no clear evidence backing up Mr. Trump's assertion that the leaders who replace them are very reasonable. Ms. Levitt told reporters that by weakening Iran's military capabilities, the United States and Israel had removed the shield that Iran was trying to erect around its nuclear weapons program. Their murderous and evil plans have been blown up quite literally and figuratively, Ms. Levitt said. But the last few weeks have shown that Iran still has other ways of punching back. Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, said it was true that the war had put U.S. military power and sophistication on display, reducing Iran's missile and drone arsenal and decimating its navy. But he noted that Iran's military was already weak before the war, and he compared U.S. claims of victory to Muhammad Ali going in and saying he's beating up a teenage boxer. The real threat that Iran continues to pose is asymmetric, Mr. Katulis said, referring to capabilities like Iran's cheap one-way attack drones, its lingering proxy network, and its control over the Strait of Hormuz. The ledger does not look great. After ceasefire, Iranians are left to pick up the pieces. By Sana Mahouzi, Leyli Nikanazar, Yaghani Torbati, and Shirin Hakim. Hours after the United States and Iran agreed to a ceasefire, pausing the immediate threat of airstrikes that Iranians have lived with for nearly 6 weeks, some Iranians were grappling with a confusing brew of emotions, relief, shock, and foreboding. Asked about how he felt about the ceasefire, Mohammed, who lives in Tehran, said he was unhappy because Iran's authoritarian government was still in place, he implied. But I didn't want the war to reach a stage where it would seriously harm all of our lives, he said. I'm worried that the economic and cultural situation of society will become worse than before. Worse than before. Communicating via text messages and voice notes sent during an ongoing internet shutdown, Iranians reflected on what they had been put through and what they might face next. Like Mohammed, others asked to be identified by their first names only or not at all, fearing reprisal from the government. People are shocked, looking at one another in disbelief, said Mariam, a 43-year-old bank employee in Tehran, who said she believed the war would restart in 2 weeks. People are exhausted and anxious. Many expressed concern about the country's economic ruin. Schools, hospitals, homes, bridges, and roads have been destroyed, as have major companies that employed tens of thousands and fueled Iran's domestic economy. Prices have skyrocketed, Mariam said. I went to buy some canned food today, and the shopkeeper advised me to stock up. It will go up 40% soon, he said. Iraj worried that popular grievances, which led to a wave of protests in January, would soon pile up again in the absence of government action to address such complaints. We still don't have proper mechanisms for protest, and there are many dissatisfied people, he said. But he said he had never liked the United States and Israel and still felt the same way. I hope other people also come to understand that they are not saviors, he said. Iranians opposed to the government said they were dismayed that it had survived, despite the killings of its top leaders and statements from U.S. and Israeli leaders earlier in the war that they wanted drastic political change in Iran. In the weeks before the bombing began, some Iranians had expressed hope that foreign intervention would lead to the toppling of the regime. Several people reached on Wednesday said they feared that in the weeks and months to come, the government would flex its power at home to reassert its authority. In recent days, Iran carried out a string of executions of people who had been arrested during the January protests. A prominent human rights lawyer was detained last week, and dozens of people have been arrested, some of them for sending information to foreign media outlets. In the days leading up to the ceasefire, the warhead upended Iranians' ability to plan their lives. Sleeping pills and anxiety medication had become hard to find, according to Mershad, 41, a businessman in Tehran, in an interview in late March. "In Tehran, people are suffering beyond words," he said. "Psychologically, many are in a very dark place. Even those who once held strong political hopes are now losing them." And armed pro-government militia members have established checkpoints on Tehran's streets, Mershad said, creating an atmosphere of fear. He and two other Iranians described regular, informal, pro-regime street gatherings in Tehran and other cities during the war, often held in the evenings. Government supporters would wave flags, he said, shouting slogans like, "God is great, Khamenei is the leader," and broadcasting religious chants over loudspeakers. All three interpreted the demonstrations as a show of force, designed to scare people away from using the wartime chaos to protest in the streets, as large crowds of Iranians had done just 3 months ago. The ceasefire was announced in a way that made it feel like the people were left on their own, facing a repressive regime alone, said Mojtaba, a 40-year-old doctor living in the northeast of the country. "Ordinary people are very worried about the future and have less hope for change compared to before the war started." Mostafa, an IT engineer living in Rasht, said that people in areas that had faced daily bombardment were happy about the ceasefire. "Many were relieved that their water, electricity, and gas would not be cut off," he said, given President Trump's threats to Iranian infrastructure. "The issue, however, is that the Islamic Republic is still in power," Mostafa said, adding that he thought the government would use public funds to rebuild its missile arsenal. For many Tehran residents, the last several weeks of war have meant a shrinking of their worlds and priorities. They began to stay indoors more, spending hours each day and precious funds trying to circumvent the internet shutdown and checking on friends and family members after strikes. Their sleep was shattered by nighttime explosions. One man in his 20s living in Tehran described his recent day-to-day: struggling for hours to find an internet connection, getting stopped at street checkpoints for searches of his car, phone, and personal belongings, and at night being frequently woke up as his entire home shook from nearby explosions. He said that months ago he had supported the idea of a foreign military intervention in Iran, motivated by desperation at the state of the country. But he had recently concluded that the war had gotten out of control. With the ceasefire in place, he said he planned to use whatever stability it might bring to make plans to leave the country. And, he added, he intended to never look back. Gilgo Beach Killer's unusual deal could help solve other murders. By Ed Shanahan. When Rex Hoyerman pleaded guilty on Wednesday to murdering 8 women, he did more than admit that he was the Gilgo Beach killer. He also took a step that could help investigators hunt down others with similarly violent minds. Raymond A. Tierney, the Suffolk County District Attorney, said at a news conference that the plea agreement called for Mr. Hoyerman to be interviewed by the FBI's behavioral analysis units about his motivation, his background. "It's sort of an academic exercise," Mr. Tierney said, describing the interviews as clinical rather than investigative in nature. Referring to the FBI analysts in comments to several reporters after the news conference, he added, "They're going to hopefully gain insight into the things that created him, that drove him, what causes this." The FBI declined to comment on Mr. Hoyerman's plea agreement, but said in a statement that the Bureau's researchers and analysts routinely conduct interviews with incarcerated offenders, including individuals convicted of serial homicide, to deepen the FBI's understanding of violent criminal behavior. That Mr. Hoyerman agreed to be interviewed by FBI analysts as part of the plea is a bit unusual, said Greg O. McCrary, a retired supervisory special agent with the Bureau who spent 10 years with the behavioral analysis units. It is not uncommon for analysts to interview serial killers and other violent criminals for insights into why they do what they do, Mr. Crary said in an interview. By now, the unit has a database filled with the results of hundreds of such interviews, he added. Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Richard Speck are among those who have spoken with analysts. But the interviews usually take place well after convictions have been secured and the criminals are in prison, he said. We let things cool off, let the headlines die down, to the point they are yesterday's news, he explained. They're the experts here, Mr. McCrary said of the interview subjects. They're the ones doing the killing, not us. Let's learn from them. In entering his plea, Mr. Hoyerman, an architect by trade, told the court he had hired his victims as escorts, strangled them, bound them in burlap, and dumped them along an oceanfront parkway on Long Island near the beach that gave the case its name. The FBI division that Mr. Hoyerman agreed to meet with was created in 1972 as the Behavioral Science Unit to consult with criminal justice professionals worldwide on different, unusual, or bizarre cases, according to its website. Its work was known then as profiling. Analysts with the unit, which has gained popular attention through movies like The Silence of the Lambs and television shows like Criminal Minds, examine an offender's motivation, victim selection, sophistication level, actions, and relationship to particular crimes, according to the website. Typically acting as consultants to state and local authorities through the unit's Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, the website says, the analysts focus on crimes that may be serial in nature, including homicides or attempted homicides that may be part of a series and or appear random or sexually motivated. Once a serial killer is in prison, Mr. McCrary added, an approach by an analyst offering him an opportunity to revisit his crimes, the killers, he said, are almost always men, taps into the latent narcissism that was probably a factor in his drive to kill, making him quick to open up. Now they're important again, Mr. McCrary said. Mr. Hoyerman's agreement to speak with bureau analysts as part of his plea, Mr. McCrary added, means that his lawyer will not intervene later to try to block an interview, easing the analyst's task. The investigation that led to Mr. Hoyerman's guilty plea began in 2010 with the discovery of four women's remains around Gilgo Beach. The inquiry stalled for years and then got a jump start in 2022 when the authorities announced the creation of a new task force dedicated to solving the case. Mr. Hoyerman was arrested the next year after investigators used cell phone data and DNA evidence taken from pizza crust, bottles, and human hairs to link him to the killings. During the investigation, court documents show, the authorities discovered that he had used so-called burner phones to search for sex workers, sadistic, torture-related pornography, and imagery and videos of women and children being sexually assaulted. Prosecutors also said he had created a document in 2000 that described his methods for finding, imprisoning, and murdering his victims. The goal of the FBI interviews will be to learn directly from Mr. Hoyerman as much as possible about what drove him to kill and to kill in the way he did, Mr. McCrary said. Information from one serial killer, he added, could be critical in catching another. And there will be another one, he said. I can almost guarantee you that. Heat wipes out western snowpack, raising fears of drought, wildfire. By Scott Dance, Sachi Kitajima Mulki, and Mira Rojanasako. After the warmest winter on record for many states and a blistering March heat wave that left almost no snow in parts of the American West, the region is facing a summer of serious wildfire risks and a drought that could force broad water restrictions. New measurements this month show most of the Mountain West won't be able to rely on melting snow, the region's largest water source, because there's hardly any snowpack there. And while some rain is forecast in the coming weeks, any spring precipitation will likely be too little too late, scientists said. It's going to be a seriously dry summer ahead, said Nels Darka, a research scientist with the Western Water Assessment at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Scientists in many parts of the West found a snow drought this month unlike any they had seen. Almost the whole region was affected, rather than just isolated pockets, said Noah Malach, a professor of hydrology at the University of Colorado, Boulder. At one key snowpack measurement site in California's Sierra Nevada, scientists last week found only traces of snow. In parts of western Colorado, mountain slopes where researchers have always measured at least 6 inches of snowpack at this time of year were virtually snowless. Across that state, snowpack was less than half of normal. Those findings were the product of a record warm winter for many western states. Through much of the winter, temperatures were simply too warm for it to snow, and precipitation fell as rain instead, unlike in previous low snow years caused by a general lack of moisture, said Carla Nemeth, director of the California Department of Water Resources. Snowpack, which builds up over the winter and spring, provides a larger, steadier, and less ephemeral source of water than rain. Then, a March heat wave across the West broke monthly temperature records in more than a dozen states, and it wiped out much of the already thin layer of winter snow. Across the upper Colorado River Basin, snowpack was about 52% of the median historical amount on March 1, already low. By April 1, it had diminished to 23% of the median, according to the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center, which released new measurements Monday. That means very little fresh water will flow out of the mountains this spring and summer. Across the Colorado River Basin, government scientists are predicting stream and river volumes will be among the smallest ever observed. The amount of spring and summer runoff forecast to reach Lake Powell, the nation's second largest reservoir and a vital store of Colorado River water on the Utah-Arizona border, is forecast to be just 22% of normal, according to the River Forecast Center. If dry weather continues, there is a growing chance, about 30% as of April 1, that water flows into the lake over the next 4 months will be the smallest on record, surpassing a 2002 drought that helped spur changes in how the Colorado is managed. Across the West, water utilities have started to call for conservation, though the measures are largely voluntary so far, because reservoir storage remains relatively healthy despite the low snow totals. Denver's water agency is seeking to cut usage by 20%, asking customers not to turn on automatic lawn sprinklers and other irrigation systems until at least mid to late May. Salt Lake City is asking residents and businesses to help cut water use by 10 million gallons per day. In Las Vegas, normal spring watering restrictions are in place, including a 12-minute limit on lawn sprinklers. Phoenix water authorities declared a Stage 1 water alert, which carries no requirements to reduce usage, but encourages residents and businesses to be mindful of drought conditions and to conserve water when possible. Across California, water authorities are closely watching their supplies, with snowpack at just 18% of normal for this time of year, said Ms. Nemeth of the state's water department. That snow typically provides about a third of California's water in any given year, she said, and virtually all of the state supply falls in the winter months. While Denver's reservoir storage is running only slightly below average, at about 80% capacity, more usage restrictions could be ahead, Denver water officials warned. This is not our first drought, and we will get through this challenging time, but we need everyone to help out this summer, in case drought conditions persist into next year and beyond, Tyrone Gant, president of the Denver Board of Water Commissioners, said last month. The conditions have already elevated fire dangers across the region, including in much of Nevada, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, Wyoming, and Montana, according to U.S. Geological Survey data that captures changes in vegetation, moisture levels, and density, as well as wind conditions. Early snowmelt and dry weather mean soils are drying out more quickly than usual, leaving vegetation more flammable. From January through March, more than 1.6 million acres burned in wildfires across the country, more than twice the average of the last decade, the National Interagency Fire Center said. The snow situation is also exacerbating tensions over water in the West. The Federal Bureau of Reclamation is writing a plan to divvy up the Colorado River's dwindling flows, one that better reflects the decades of drought that is forecast to continue as the climate changes in the West. A century-old agreement among states that use the river's water was last updated in 2007, and its rules aren't keeping up with changing hydrology. It expired at the end of last year. Kyle Roerink, executive director of the Great Basin Water Network, a Nevada-based advocacy group, said he hopes this year's challenging conditions spark deeper conversations about how the West must adapt to a drier future. This might be what it takes to get us to truly adapt to 21st century realities, Mr. Roerink said. If we believe what the top scientists are saying, this isn't the worst it's going to get in the 21st century. Odds are also increasing that an intense episode of the global climate pattern El Niño will develop later this year, and it isn't clear how that may affect Western water fortunes. The pattern has in the past led to warmer than normal conditions across the Southwest, potentially increasing drought. But it is also known for sending soaking rains across the southern tier of the United States during the winter months. In some past El Niño years, predictions of increased precipitation for the Southwest failed to materialize because day-to-day weather patterns that carry eastern Pacific moisture can vary, Mr. Jarka said. It's not a guarantee, he said. It's difficult at this point to plan for that. Confronting the looming water challenges will take infrastructure that can better capture rain and snowmelt and can use it more efficiently through solutions such as recycling, said Ms. Nemeth, the California water official. This is us experiencing the realities of warmer temperatures that come with climate change, Ms. Nemeth said. It's going to challenge our historic water practices in the state. To boost military budget, Trump targets popular programs at home. By Tony Rahm and Annie Carney. For decades, the U.S. government has helped poor Americans pay their home heating and cooling bills. It sends money to states, which then administer the aid, assisting nearly 6 million households nationally. With a roughly $4 billion budget, the bipartisan program known as LIHEAP is just a sliver of a sprawling federal balance sheet that ranges well into the trillions each year. Yet it counts among the vast set of federal aid that President Trump is trying to eliminate as he scrounges for ways to cut costs at home and fund a larger, more expensive military. Mr. Trump has eyed a series of potentially unpopular and divisive domestic spending cuts for the next fiscal year in a move that may test the political appetite and financial health of a cost-weary American public. Even as voters grow more frustrated with the economy and seem eager to exact their vengeance at the ballot box, the president has proposed to scale back some of the very federal programs that are meant to ease families' toughest financial burdens. By the president's own reasoning, the U.S. government cannot afford the expense. At a private lunch last week, Mr. Trump insisted that Washington needed to prioritize military protection above all else, especially with the United States still at war with Iran. Otherwise, he said in a since-deleted video, the country could not continue to shoulder the financial burden of services including daycare, Medicare, and Medicaid. Formalizing that view in his 2027 budget, Mr. Trump did not address Medicare and Medicaid directly. But he did ask Congress to slash about $73 billion next fiscal year across a wide array of domestic agencies and programs, including education, healthcare, housing, and nutrition assistance. He coupled that call for cuts with a request to ratchet up military spending by more than $400 billion, which would amount to one of the largest one-year boosts in modern history. Mr. Trump's approach angered congressional Democrats and even some Republicans, months after the two parties banded together to reject broad swaths of his last budget. That included his previous attempt to eliminate LIHEAP, formerly known as the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which Congress not only preserved this fiscal year, but also supplied with additional funding. In an interview, Representative Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York and the minority leader, called Mr. Trump's latest budget an extraordinary admission of Republican policy cruelty that they've been inflicting on the American people in real time since the very beginning of his presidency. Mr. Jeffries said he was extremely optimistic that Democrats would win back control of the House in November by a large margin, partly because of Mr. Trump's actions. He added, "Republicans don't give a damn about making life more affordable for the American people." The White House has sought to frame its actions much differently. In a letter accompanying the president's budget, Russell T. Vought, the budget director, wrote last week that the goal is to ensure that the United States continues to maintain the world's most powerful and capable military. Turning to the proposed cuts, Mr. Vought described many of the targeted programs as wasteful or woke, adding that the administration had aimed to use every tool at its disposal to achieve real savings. The White House also claimed in a statement on Tuesday that it had targeted LIHEAP in particular because the money was riddled with fraud and was not needed because states could fill the gap on their own. A spokeswoman added that the funds had disproportionately benefited Democrats. For Mr. Trump, the renewed debate over federal spending nevertheless arrives at a perilous political and economic moment. Before the bombing began, many Americans had reported frustration with stubbornly high prices, even though the president routinely dismissed concerns about affordability as a hoax. But public angst has only intensified as Mr. Trump has ratcheted up his wartime threats, sending the average price at the pump to $4.14 per gallon nationally on Tuesday. The geopolitical uncertainty has also rattled financial markets, creating new headaches for Americans' retirement and savings. "They see the price, they remember it," said Mark Wolf, the executive director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, referring to oil and gas costs. Mr. Wolf, whose group advocates the government's low-income energy assistance programs, added, "People are concerned about it." With no end to the hostilities in sight, economists have warned that other tumult may soon follow. High oil prices could soon translate to higher costs for groceries and other shipped goods, causing a potential slowdown in the nation's growth, a worsening in unemployment, and, in a worst-case scenario, a possible U.S. recession. Throughout the war, Mr. Trump has brushed aside any economic fallout as non-existent, temporary, or inconsequential, arguing that the United States needed to neutralize an imminent nuclear threat. But the president's bombing campaign was only the latest in a string of recent military entanglements, which prompted the White House to seek about $1.5 trillion for defense in the 2027 budget, unveiled on Friday. As part of that request, Mr. Trump called on Congress to raise pay for lower-ranking troops, increase money for naval warships, ramp up a new missile defense system, and replenish U.S. munitions. If enacted, it would be the second increase for the military during the president's second term, after he secured roughly $150 billion in new funds for the Pentagon as part of his sweeping package of tax cuts last year. Democrats vigorously objected to the president's military request, and many took quick issue with the way he sought to offset it, arguing that Mr. Trump had essentially asked the public to front the cost for a war that it did not want. Mr. Jeffries, for one, described the approach as an open acknowledgement that the Republican Party is all about warfare, not health care. Mr. Trump proposed to slash more than $15 billion at the Department of Health and Human Services, once again targeting federally funded medical research, though the cuts he sought were less stark than those proposed 1 year ago. The White House also called for revoking about $15 billion in money meant to combat climate change, reprising its desire to eliminate funds that improve clean energy and clamp down on harmful emissions. Together, those cuts and others would sum to roughly 10% reduction in all domestic spending, according to White House estimates. The depth of those changes troubled at least one senior Republican, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who leads the Appropriations Committee. In a statement last week, she said the president's budget had shortcomings, pointing to cuts for programs like LIHEAP. After careful review, Congress decisively rejected these particular cuts last year, she said. Some of Mr. Trump's harshest proposals targeted money meant to improve lending to minority communities and small businesses, while others reprised the president's attempts to eliminate the Education Department. And his administration pursued a series of changes to federal nutrition assistance, one of which could reduce the amount that low-income families receive for fruit and vegetables under the Women, Infants, and Children program, according to anti-hunger groups. Mr. Trump did recommend a substantial increase in emergency WIC funds. Still, his proposal followed less than a year after Republicans cemented new restrictions under the government's largest anti-hunger initiative, known as food stamps, which serves roughly 42 million Americans. Millions are expected to lose benefits in the coming years as a result of the new criteria, which lawmakers imposed to pay for a portion of their expensive package of tax cuts. On Capitol Hill, some Republicans have openly signaled that they could adopt a similar approach in the coming fiscal year as they look for ways to deliver Mr. Trump's request for more military funding. Party leaders are expected to try to boost defense using the same special legislative tactic that had allowed them to adopt their tax package over Democratic objections in 2025. We just addressed Medicaid and SNAP, but there are 70-plus means-tested welfare programs across this entire people's government and about $1.5 trillion cost, said Representative Jody Arrington of Texas, the Republican chairman of the Budget Committee, referring to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. He added in the interview, which appeared on Fox Business, that the programs could be mined for potential savings by rooting out fraud. Democrats have seized on those comments as they try to make the case to voters that they would be harmed if Republicans remain in control of Congress. Many anti-poverty advocates have echoed those warnings about the stark effects of spending cuts at a moment when families are already facing serious financial headaches. That concludes this Thursday's reading from the New York Times. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.